I hope you appreciate our young people as much as they deserve to be appreciated. We have a great group of young men and young women who are growing into servant and leadership roles and just doing a fantastic job. And I don't know what happened about the division of labor back there, but I originally asked Stephen Wetzel if he'd do prayer. And then I noticed some of our young folks, so I went and asked Colton, and somehow Gabe got in there to do it. So what I love about it is it's just handled. You don't have to worry about it. They'll take care of it. They'll handle it. And I still remember Gabe when he was just terrified. I get that. I totally get the terror of being in front of people, and especially leading a congregation in prayer. But just our young men and our young women are just amazing people, and we're thankful to our parents and for our teachers and for those that are working with them in LTC and for our shepherds that are shepherding them, and just thankful for the family, the village that's helping these young people become what God has called them to be. I hope you appreciate them as much as they deserve to be appreciated. We're in Acts chapter 20. We started in we kind of dipped our toe into Acts chapter 20 last week. We'll come back to it. Paul has been working with the church in Ephesus. He has seen the church growing and maturing, and as he watches the church come into its own, he is starting to look ahead and look beyond that particular congregation. Acts chapter 19, verse 21 says, after all this had happened, this is the burning of the scrolls. Paul decided, he purposed, he resolved in the spirit to go to Jerusalem. So he's decided the church is now at a place where it can continue to grow and thrive on its own. And he says he's going to go to Jerusalem, passing through Macedonia and Achaia. And he says, after I've been there, I must go visit Rome or go see Rome. So he's got plans. He wants to strengthen the churches in Macedonia and Achaia, and he's still, at the point we come to the Acts chapter 20, Paul's still waiting for word back from the Corinthians for what is described in 2 Corinthians 2, 12 and 13 as his severe letter, and Paul, I think, is kind of sitting on pins and needles. He has written a letter to the church that is very direct, very forward, in calling them to correct some really serious issues that are there in the church. And he's not at all certain how they'll take it, how they'll respond to it, whether they'll receive it well or whether they'll reject him. And so he's waiting anxiously for word from that, but he also wants to get the collection, and the collection of money he's taken from the largely Gentile churches in the east to the Jerusalem church in the west as something of a, certainly for benevolence, and also as something of a peace offering. And I think Paul sees this as this offering as a way of binding together these two very different groups, the largely Gentile churches in the West and the mostly Jewish church in Jerusalem. Once he does that, he wants to go on to Rome, but there's problems ahead, and he knows that. He's been warned and continues to be warned that things may not go as planned. So let's pick back up where we left off last week. Let's go to Acts chapter 20. Let's just for refreshing read those first six verses, and then we'll come back into the lesson. Acts 20, beginning of verse 1. When the uproar had ended, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. He traveled through that area, speaking many words of encouragement to the people, and finally arrived in Greece, where he stayed 3 months. Because the Jews made a plot against him, just as he was about to sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. He was accompanied by Sopater, son of Pyrrhus from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy also, and Tychicus and Trophimus from the province of Asia. These men went on ahead and waited for us at Troas. There's the us section in verse 5 where Luke joins him again. But we sailed from Philippi after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and 5 days later joined the others at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. We'll stop there. So Paul has a very deep sense of obligation and duty to the church in Ephesus. It's a very difficult city to be a believer in, with the one of the seven wonders of the world in its day, which is the temple for Artemis or for Diana. The citizens there have been preoccupied with superstition and with sorcery, and they still are, even though the church has turned its back on it. And Christians are not looked on highly either by their pagan neighbors. You see that in chapter 19, verse 33 and 34, or by their Jewish neighbors, chapter 19, verse 9. So the church has a lot of hurdles to cross, a lot of problems ahead of it. And so Paul's very concerned, he says, with encouraging, verse 1, the disciples. He's also concerned, verse 2, with the church in Corinth and actually losing the church in Corinth. And so he's waiting for a word from Timothy. So, I'm sorry, Titus. He sent Titus to Corinth with this severe letter. We don't have that letter, don't have a reference to it. All we know is what's referenced in the letters, the 1st and 2nd Corinthians that we do have. And Paul was excited about a door that was open in Troas for evangelism, but he says in verse 2, has no peace of mind, his spirit is not at rest, because he did not find Titus there. He did not find Titus, and not so much worried about Titus, although he is concerned about him, but he's concerned about word back from Titus for how the Corinthians received his letter. If they reject the letter, then Paul's already decided that they are rejecting him, and he will not make another painful visit, he says in 2 Corinthians 2:1. And so he had hoped to rendezvous with Titus in Troas, but when that didn't happen, he went on to Macedonia. He finally does find Titus in Macedonia, and Titus brings good news. You can read about that in 2 Corinthians chapter 7. The church in Corinth has accepted Paul's letter, which means they have accepted Paul. They have addressed the concerns that Paul raises in his severe letter. They've welcomed Titus, the one who delivered the severe letter. And so Paul is very, very thankful for the good news. And so he writes the believers in Corinth another letter, the one we call 2 Corinthians. And he sends that letter back to Corinth with Titus and two other unnamed messengers in 2 Corinthians 8:16. You can read about that. Now, as a result of the good news from Titus, Paul goes on to Corinth. It says, verse 3, where he stayed for 3 months. Luke doesn't tell us exactly how he spent his 3 months, but I think we can probably guess. Based on what he's done before in his previous work, where do you suppose he started? Synagogue. He goes to the synagogue. He works at the synagogue. He encourages the believers. He writes, by the way, while he's there in Corinth, the timing is such that it looks like he wrote the letter that we call Romans, the letter to the church in Rome there. But he spends 3 months there, and after that, he's ready to return to Jerusalem. He still is very, very eager to get that collection to the church, to the believers in Jerusalem. He also probably, by all accounts, wants to tell the church in Jerusalem about the advances that are made in the church in Ephesus, about their maturing and in their growth, and what they've done in terms of rejecting the superstition of their community and embracing the truth of God and his word. He wants to tell them about the door of evangelism that was open in Troas. He wants to also renew his relationship with the Christians in Corinth. So there's a lot that Paul has on his plate, including delivering that money to the believers in the East. But it says in verse 3 that the Jews have made a plot against him. They've laid weight against him. Now, if you remember back at the end of Paul's second missionary journey, he was having a lot of opposition. The Jews from Achaia, which includes Corinth and Athens, made a united attack against Paul. That's in Acts chapter 18, verse 12. And evidently that opposition hasn't weakened. They haven't, even though time has passed and he's now on his third mission trip, they haven't lost their anxiety over Paul, their hatred of his message. And so Paul's original plan was to sail for Syria, probably Antioch there in Syria, which would be the quickest route to Jerusalem. But because of this plot, he goes back the opposite direction, traveling north through Macedonia, rather than south to the port in Cenchrea. Verses 4, 5, and 6, Paul's traveling companions. These are probably representatives from the various churches. Imagine if we were to do this today. Imagine if the churches in Oklahoma took up, Oklahoma, took up a collection for the impoverished believers in South America. Okay, so we've contributed, Broken Arrow's contributed, so Paul, the area churches have contributed, and now somebody is taking all that money to South America to give it to the impoverished churches. Wouldn't it be prudent for us to send somebody from our congregation carrying our contribution, and somebody from Broken Arrow and somebody from Sepulpa to go with that one person, so that first of all, one person doesn't have to carry all that money, and second of all, that one person can come back to this congregation and talk about what they've experienced. You know, when Stuart went on his mission work, he came back and said, let me tell you what we experienced. Let me tell you what happened there. And so that's very much thought to be the companions that Paul is traveling with. They're appointed by the churches to carry that church's portion of the offering. And we're not told in verses 5 and 6 why Paul and his traveling companions split up, but they do. These men, verse 5 says, went on ahead and waited for us at Troas, but we sailed from Philippi after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and 5 days later joined the others at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. Any guesses? I mean, I hope you can see some value in this. We can't lock it down. We don't want to be dogmatic about it, but there is something to be gained about trying to put ourselves in their place and trying to understand what's going on in their world. If you were part of this group, what might be a reason for you to split up?
Cover more territory.
Cover more territory, okay. Two directions are better than one. What else? Evade your enemies. What else? Well, if one group is robbed, evade your enemies. The other group can still hopefully carry through and bring the money there. There's several different reasons. Probably all three that we've decided here are very good and very, very plausible reasons for that. Whatever the reason is, Troas is the rendezvous point yet again, and the delegates take a quicker route to Troas, presumably by boat. And Paul and Luke, that's where the we section picks up. The last time we had a we section was in chapter 16. And so Luke has evidently separated himself from Paul and recording from a distance, but now he's in chapter 20, joined back up with him. And after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, some of your translations say the days or the Festival of Unleavened Bread in Philippi, Paul and Luke head to Troas. Feast of Unleavened Bread, what was that? What were they celebrating, commemorating, remembering? This was their remembrance of their swift departure from Egypt. Yeah. So we don't have time for the bread to rise. We're going to leave this, the unleavened bread. So this was their annual remembrance of that and their celebration. And some people suggest that Paul was celebrating the Feast of Unleavened Bread with the Jews there in Philippi. Others suggest Luke is just giving us a timeline. You pick which side of one of those you like best. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is celebrated in late March or early April. The Romans, so here's, why would Luke give us that as a time stamp for the travel? It has to do with maybe why they stayed and waited for the day of Passover, for this particular celebration. And quite possibly the reason is safe travel. It was considered in those days to be dangerous to sail after September 15th as the season becomes dangerous with storms blowing in and fronts coming through. And almost suicidal to sail after November 11th, the early part of November. And so maybe one reason Paul stayed in Corinth 3 months. And so here's the question. Paul's anxious to get to Jerusalem for the day of Pentecost, but he stays in Corinth for 3 months. Why? The most logical reason, plausible reason, is because of safety and travel. He needs to wait for the severe weather to pass, for the dangerous traveling season to pass. So, verse 16, Paul wants to reach Jerusalem, if possible, by the day of Pentecost. And since the Feast of Unleavened Bread began at Passover, there are some 50 days from Passover to Pentecost. So starting here in verse 16, we have a 50-day countdown. A 50-day countdown for Paul to make it to Jerusalem by the day of Pentecost when he wants to be there. So the voyage from Philippi to Troas took 5 days. By the way, that same voyage in chapter 16 took 2 days going the other way. So prevailing winds, favorable seas, all of that goes into play. But it took 5 days. And then the 7 days in Troas, 5 and 7, 12. Now we have a 50-day countdown, and 12 are gone. 5 days in travel, 7 days in Troas. And that's why it says Paul is in a hurry, verse 16. He is hastening. He's running out of time. The clock is ticking down. All right. Paul's in a hurry. He's encouraged. He still prioritizes strengthening the disciples. Let's go back into our text and let's read a few more verses. Acts chapter 20. Let's pick up in verse 7. On the first day of the week, we came together to break bread. Paul spoke to the people, and because he intended to leave the next day, kept on talking until midnight. We'll come back to that. I'm sorry. There were many lamps in the upstairs room where they were meeting, where we were meeting. Seated in a window was a young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on, the NIV says. When he was sound asleep, he fell to the ground from the third story and was picked up dead. Interesting phrase. Paul went down, threw himself on the young man, and put his arms around him. Don't be alarmed, he said. He is alive. When he went upstairs again and broke bread and ate, after talking until daylight, he left. The people took the young man home alive and were greatly comforted. So here's biblical support for preaching for long sermons. Right? And that's what I get. Isn't what you get out of it? That's what I get out of it. I'm sure that's the inspired text and the timeless truth I'm supposed to draw from the inspired text. First day of the week. Been an important day since the beginning of Christianity. Always carried a great deal of significance. The first day of the week is when Jesus' disciples found his empty tomb. And an angel asked them in Luke chapter 24, "Why do you look for the living among the dead?" One of the most profound questions in all of Scripture. The Savior who has been crucified, the one who is dead, is no longer here. Why are you looking here? With 2,000 years of history behind us, we can look at that. So, well, of course he was risen, and of course he's not going to be there. Shouldn't they know that? But on that day, that was a profound statement. Why are you looking for the living among the dead? 1 Corinthians chapter 16, on the first day of the week, believers are instructed to set aside a sum of money in keeping with their income. We learn on the first day of the week that believers came together to break bread, celebrate the Lord's Supper. And Paul was in a hurry, verse 16, to reach Jerusalem, if possible, by the day of Pentecost. But he stayed in Troas 7 days. So now 19 of his 50 days are gone. We're in a countdown. What's that song? Time is slipping, slipping, slipping. It could have been possible that the ship that they on which they had booked passage was not leaving until those 7 days. This is my opinion. You're welcome to reject it. I believe it's probably more likely that he stayed there to celebrate the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. That was very important to Paul, as it ought to be for all of us. And so I think that was. I would lean toward that as to why he stayed there. Paul has only one chance to speak to the congregation, so he makes the most of it. By the way, totally joking about long sermons and all that stuff. So don't let my joke about long sermons color your answer. What are we to glean from this passage of him? Let's see. From him in his long sermon. On the first day of the week, we came together to break bread. Paul spoke to the people, and because he intended to leave the next day, this is verse 7, he kept on talking until midnight. Verse 8, I'm sorry, that's a good enough, we'll stay there. Talking until midnight, and then Paul talked on and on until daylight. What are we to glean from that? He had a lot to say. All right, he had a lot to say. And he has a lot to say, and he doesn't know if or when he'll have another chance to say it.
He spoke with urgency as well. A lot of times you never know when the Lord will return. It felt to them like it could be the following day. I mean, I know we talking about it sometimes like it's never going to happen anymore, you know.
Right. It's been 2,000 years. Yeah.
They felt like it was going to happen next week, so we've got to be ready.
The consensus was as soon as we can get the gospel out there, Christ is coming back. You know, as soon as everybody gets a chance to hear and respond, he's going to. So, and I think that's why one of the reasons why Paul was so adamant. I don't want a spouse. I don't want a family. I don't want any encumbrances. I want to go out and proclaim, and I wish everybody else could, because the sooner that happens, we can go home to heaven. So there was this clear expectation of a much quicker return of Christ than what Christ has done. So all of these things were in play, and so he speaks on and on. The NIV says, which is an interesting translation, but it probably conveys the thought on and on. I've known preachers and probably been that preacher who talks more than he should because he doesn't say things concisely and correctly the first way, and so I can try to take another look at it again and take another look at it. And I remember in preaching school, they said, when you quit, just quit all over. You know, like the preacher that says now, finally, for the third time, you know, when you quit, quit all over. You'd have a hard time convincing me that's what Paul's doing. I think what we've already talked about is exactly what he's doing. There's so much to cover, and there's so much important to be said. Doesn't know if I have a chance to come back and either repeat it or further the teaching. This is important. He's going to preach, and he's going to cover what needs to be covered. So let me make a case here. No? Okay, before we do that, you make the case. What should we learn as a 21st century church in the West? Is there anything we should learn from that? Anything we should learn from that particular instance from the first century church in the Near East to apply to the 21st century church in the West?
Yeah.
We may be a little clock conscious, a little too clock conscious. I remember when I was in preaching school, we came up to a little church in Tigard, Oklahoma. Does that ring a bell? It's right on the border. Anyway, I think it's Tigard, Oklahoma. And they had a little church there, and they had a little parsonage next door. And so they would and Tigard, Oklahoma. They took it upon themselves to make it their ministry, and I'm grateful if they did, to try to knock some of the rough edges off us new preachers. You know, it's hard enough to be a new preacher, much less to have to listen to a new preacher. And so they would bring the new preachers in, and we would go in there, and we would preach and teach Sunday morning, and then we would stay. The parsonage was empty, so we'd stay in the parsonage in the afternoon, and then we'd come back and preach in the evening. And you got a little bit of a sense that one of the things that this church wanted to teach their young up-and-coming preachers was time management, because when you get in the pulpit, there's a clock on the wall, there's a clock on the front pew, and there's a clock on the lectern. And then there's a little gentleman, an octogenarian gentleman in the congregation that had a watch. And if you went over, he would do this. And so you get a sense that one of the things they want to teach is time management, which is great. So here, we as a congregation have a responsibility to hunger for the word and to be open to hear the word and to be hear the word expounded upon, brought out and taught. Agreed? Okay, and those who take our time preaching and teaching have a responsibility to be prepared and speak with plans and with spirit-led lessons and start and end and not waste our time. Agreed? And all of us at different times have different levels of success in hungering for the word and being well prepared and delivering the word well. But we ought to be people who this is this shouldn't be a task. If it is, then maybe we need a heart check. We need to be people who are open to it. I will say this, the idea that Paul started it at the scriptural time of 10:30 in the morning and then preached till midnight probably is a little, it's probably us imposing our 21st century Western practices on the first century church. It wouldn't be at all surprising if the first century church didn't start until after dark. Any ideas why they might wait until the sun goes down just to have a worship assembly? I'm sorry?
To cool down
the facility? It's probably hot. Okay, good point. The early church was populated very much by the lower class, by the lower income. It was not in that day and time. Much of the lower middle and lower class worked sun up to sundown 7 days a week. If you're a servant, if you're a slave, if you're a field worker, you're going to work as long as some sun up to sundown, and you don't have a choice. And so it wouldn't be at all uncommon for the church to wait until sundown so that all of us could come together, so we could all spend time together. Because if we have it at 10:30, a big chunk of our congregation is going to be out in the fields working or working for their masters. And so it's entirely possible that the sermon started to after dark. And then, as the NIV says, he preached on and on and on. And we'll talk about that when we get to 1 Corinthians in that passage. So verse 7, Paul kept talking on and on until midnight. He prolonged or continued his speech until midnight. And poor Eutychus just can't keep up with Paul's preaching. Verse 9. First known case of a preacher literally boring somebody to death. Not the last case, but the first case. First part of verse 9. Seated in a window was a young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on, or as some translations say, was long preaching. There's a Brad Paisley song, and it just makes me laugh because I can see myself in it on both sides. And there's nothing worse than a long-winded preacher on a sunny Sunday. And so he's dreaming of taking his father-in-law's boat out on the lake as soon as the preacher gets done, but the preacher drones on and on. Well, poor Eutychus, I don't know if he was thinking about taking his father-in-law's boat out or not, but whatever it was more than he could handle, and so he falls out the window, and it fall proves fatal. And Luke, the physician, tells us that the young man was picked up dead. What an interesting terminology. What an interesting turn of a phrase. He was picked up dead. Thoughts on that? Maybe that was just Luke's way of turning a phrase. But to me, that strikes me as a very strange way to say deceased. Thoughts on picked up dead?
Confirmation.
Certainly confirmation, right? We have Luke the physician telling us he's dead. That's not like me saying that, who doesn't know one way or the other. But so we have a literal confirmation. So there's no question he didn't swoon like some of the theories of Christ's death. He didn't swoon. He didn't pass out from the heat. He was actually deceased. But picked up dead. The thought is that maybe somebody came and cradled Eutychus' body in their arms. If he's a young man, maybe mom or dad came and picked him up and cradled him, and Luke comes and says, no, I'm sorry to tell you, but he's gone. So there's if you're like me, and if you are, I'm sorry that you share the craziness with me, but if I can, pictures in my head, the thought of mom or me, a dad, rushing to my son and putting him in my arm and holding him and the physician coming saying, I'm sorry, but your son's gone, gives me a little bit of a... I can read the words, and the words I can pass over, and I can go, yeah, that's history and that's done, without really feeling the feel. But that kind of picture touches my heart in a way that just reading the words doesn't. The sense of loss. Heaven forbid, but what if our young people, the young people that we're talking about being so proud of in this congregation, what if one of them, somebody came bursting through those doors and said, one of them's gone. What would go through our mind? What would be in our hearts? Besides just utter devastation and heartbreak. I mean, I can't imagine how devastating that would be. And so I'm saying all that to try to help us get in that moment for just a moment, because it matters. It's being shared to us with the physician saying he's deceased. He was picked up dead to tell us that something momentous has happened in this congregation. Paul's preaching is profound, and he's laying out the gospel for the first time to a lot of people. That's wonderful, but something else profound has happened, and a death of someone whose life is tragically cut too short has happened in the midst of a worship assembly while the brothers and sisters are there, and there's been a great loss. So please tell me you can feel just a little bit of that sense of tragedy, of heartbreak, of gut-wrenching, just horror, loss. And because what comes next depends on that. Verse 10, Paul threw himself on the young man. Some translations say fell on him or embraced him. This has echoes of the Old Testament. This is God revealing himself yet again, as he has done before in some of the great prophets of the Old Testament. This is reminiscent of Elijah in 1 Kings 17:21. This is reminiscent of Elisha in 2 Kings 4:34. Paul threw himself on the young man, and like Peter, who raised Tabitha from the dead, into Acts chapter 9, verse 40, Paul's power to heal reflects the same kind of power to heal as seen in the Gospels. So, poor man, Eutychus, falls out the window dead. Paul comes and lays on him and raises him back from the dead. And of course, now knowing Paul, what's the proper response to this? Let's preach some more. This will preach. What do you suppose the message was Paul preached when he went back into the auditorium?
Resurrection.
Resurrection from the dead, right? Yeah. You don't want to be like Eutychus when he was picked up dead. You want to be like Eutychus when he's back here with us. What do you suppose the spirit was in the congregation? Contrast the spirit of the congregation when they're all rushing outside to see him fallen to the ground dead versus when they go back into the worship assembly to rejoin again as a congregation. Contrast the emotion of the congregation in those two scenes. A little more ready to listen. everybody's a little more awake now. They've seen from horror to elation, from devastation to overwhelming joy. Almost giddy. Wouldn't you think they would be almost giddy? They've seen a miracle. That's crazy enough. But then one of their youngsters have been restored to them. So the swing has to have been just amazing, beyond comprehension. And so he goes, verse 11, to break bread. Not really sure. There's different thoughts, and I have my own opinion. But some see breaking bread as Luke's kind of code phrase for communion. It could be. It could be just simply they shared a meal together. It could be that it was a meal that was a part of communion, because in the first century, in the early church, we've talked about this before, communion was part of a fellowship meal called the Love Feast. And that's why, one of the reasons why, one of the accusations made against Christians were they're cannibals, because they have a Love Feast, and during the Love Feast, they eat this man's flesh and they drink this man's blood. A total perversion and misunderstanding of the communion, but because of the Love Feast that was associated with communion, it gave some legs to that lie. So if that's the case, so we talked about maybe the message was resurrection. What does Jesus say when he institutes the Lord's Supper? Proclaim his death until what? Until he returns. He was dead. He's alive. He's gone, he's coming back. Is there any better acted out sermon on that than Eutychus? Eutychus was dead and he's back. Guess what? Christ was dead and buried and he's coming back. Just as Eutychus came back into our auditorium, wherever they were meeting. Jesus is coming back. What do you suppose was the attitude of the Spirit? If at this meal or at the love feast or at communion, whatever it was, breaking bread, what do you suppose the attitude was when they sat around the table and broke bread together?
Celebration.
I'm sorry?
Celebration.
Yeah. I mean, so we're celebrating a family being created here this coming Sunday. Can you imagine celebrating a life being given back to us? I think there's something to be learned there. Paul's refreshed. He re-energizes, and he preaches until midnight. And the believers in Troas love and respect Paul enough to stay there and listen to him. I was joking with somebody here the other day, and I said something about, I don't remember, joking about, oh, we were worried about the clock because the clock wasn't, that atomic clock is out of atoms because evidently it wasn't keeping up with the time change. And so the clock had been pulled off and it was being readjusted. And I said, well, if the clock's not there, I can preach as long as I want. Right? And so if the clock's not there, there's nothing to tell me to quit. You know how to ignore the bell, so I can just go as long as I want. And whoever it was said, well, you talk all you want. We're leaving 11:30. Well, I nothing I didn't already know.
Whenever he talks about, he talked till midnight.
Yeah.
And then it's the story of Eutychus. Does that mean he talked till midnight and that event happened after midnight?
Okay.
You see what I mean? Because it says in verse 7.
Yeah, he talked till daylight. Verse 12, verse 11, he talks till daylight. Yeah.
Well, you know what? I mean, just curiosity.
No, we're keeping wrong time. They don't keep time by midnight. They keep time by sundown. So it's sundown. Sunday comes at sundown.
So midnight.
Sundown to sundown. Midnight is irrelevant to them. Sundials don't work at midnight.
Okay.
And so midnight is our timekeeping. It's not theirs. Their timekeeping is sundown to sundown. So the Lord's day started at sundown, and then Paul preached till midnight. Then Eutychus died, and then Paul preached till daylight. So this is all Sunday. So don't let the time midnight thing throw you for a loop. That's not how they keep time. They keep time. The new day starts at sundown. Does that make sense?
Sort of, kinda.
Well, if I can make sort of kinda sense, I'm pleased with that. All right, daylight, verse 12 and 13, Paul and his companions and the believers in Troas part company. Interesting, verse 13, Paul heads to Troas, to Assos, on foot heading south, and verse 13, his companions sail 40 miles around the peninsula. So Paul walks 20 miles, they sail 40 miles, not really sure why. And the believers took this young man, Eutychus, home alive and were greatly comforted. At least one translation, I'm not sure how many, say not a little comforted, which is kind of like another interesting turn of phrase. Picked him up dead and not a little comforted. Same thing, just a different way to say it. Greatly comforted, beyond comfort. Remember the theme of Acts. I'm just going to ask this every Wednesday night until y'all are so sick and tired of it. The unstoppable church. The gospel continues. Nothing will stop the progression of the gospel. Nothing. Jail, imprisonment, intimidation, death. Nothing stops the advance of the gospel. God is not going to allow anything, whether it's Judaizers or legalists or opposition, nothing. God's not going to let anything stop the gospel. The gospel advances despite the enormous pressure that Paul feels as an apostle. And I hope we'll spend enough time later on to really get a sense for just how much weight Paul carried on his shoulders as an apostle. just this sense of burden that he felt, and not an ugly burden, but a God-given burden for the churches. Paul wasn't in it for the money. He wasn't in it for the glory. He wasn't in it so he can be remembered in Sunday school classes in 2025, whatever year this is. He was doing it because he had a burden for God's people. He had a burden for God and a burden for God's message. Maybe a little bit that he feels like he has a lot to make up for when he was Saul of Tarsus, but he certainly has a burden for the church. So the gospel advances despite the pressure he feels. It advances despite the fact that Paul's time in the mission field is coming, drawing to a close. It advances despite the fact, or maybe because Eutychus falls to his death. I'm telling you that the invitation song that Sunday night had better be good. I told the elders when they hired me here, I said, I don't really want to retire. I just want to die in the pulpit. I've said that before, right? I just want to die in the pulpit and let you all worry about what happens with my body. But whoever gives the invitation, they better do a good job that night. I think the same thing's true with Eutychus. The gospel advances not maybe despite of Eutychus, but because of what God does with him. The gospel advances. That's the theme of Acts. Nothing stops the advance of the gospel. Thoughts, comments? Larry, and then Stuart.
You know, I can remember through the years there's a lot of ministers that I've been around that can speak a long time, and I wouldn't even
right.
You know, notice it. And then there's been others that would that.
There's something you have to work to listen to, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
To make sure that we put the word of God in there and that we listen to it.
We have to come prepared to tune in. And I'll say this. Please take this the way it's intended. It's not a bad thing if we have to work to listen to a preacher. There are some preachers that are just gifted, and they can just there's some people that you just listen to and you just go, really, the time's already gone, and we're just now got started. And then there's some that you just look at the clock, like 5 minutes. That's all that's passed since the last time I looked at the clock. And maybe, you know, some preachers have great days and bad days and everything in between. But you know, one of the things that's interesting is God never apologizes that Bible study's hard work. The Hebrew letter, by now you ought to be teachers, but you're still on milk. You know, you should be chewing on the meatier parts of the text, but I have to teach you about this all over again. God never apologizes that studying his word is difficult. He never apologizes for that. I think maybe quit trying to justify. You take it for what you want to take it for. I think that extends even into hearing preachers and teachers. I don't think there's an apology needed for someone who's hard to listen to, someone we have to work to get something out of. Because if we have to work to get something out of God's word, it makes sense that we ought to be willing to work to get something out of somebody's message. That's not trying to excuse for me trying to be a lazy or poor preacher. That's just saying that we are in such an entertainment culture, we're in such an entertainment society, that we get so used to saying, well, this, I remember somebody saying, well, you know, I hope you're good today because I'm tired. You better keep my attention. You know, if the gospel of God's word didn't keep your attention, there's no, what hope do I have? You know, well, hope you grow the church. Well, if the gospel didn't, if we can't get excited about the gospel and somebody doing their best to try to bring the gospel, then maybe we need a heart check. If God's not apologizing for the scriptures being hard to study, maybe we shouldn't apologize for working to hear the message from preachers and teachers and people who have good days and bad days, skilled and unskilled, and those who are ridiculous enough to come think they have something worth saying in front of people have an obligation to be prepared and be ready, but we also have an obligation to work and be willing to work to get something out of that. End of sermon. So.
Okay. So here's some word nerd stuff.
Word nerd?
Bear with me. Picked up dead translates from the Greek word hiero, which is used in the Bible in conjunction with losing your life. First time is in Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 is what's quoted in Acts chapter 8 when Peter meets the eunuch. So Here it is. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. Who can describe his generation? For his life is taken away from the earth, Hiram. It's also used in John chapter 10, verse 18. This is Jesus speaking. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it up again, Hiram. This charge I have received from my Father. So I don't know if Luke meant that, but there's definitely a connection.
Okay. All right. Word nerd. I like my word nerds. Yeah. Thank you, Stuart. Anybody else?
Well, every sermon, if it's taught from the Bible, has got something for us.
Yeah.
Whether we are interested in the preacher or anything else, we're interested in the Word.
We're interested in the Word, and the preacher's job is to stay out of the way of the Word and try to proclaim the Word. And it's our job to look for the nuggets that we can take out of that. And my problem is I'll sit there and I'll think, well, that's not the way I would have said that. I'll critique the preacher. And if I'm not careful, I'll go through the whole thing and fail to worship. And what a shame it is to get up and get dressed and drive all the way to church and go sit in an auditorium and fail to do what you came there for, or fail to worship. I have to remind myself, it's not my job to critique him. It's my job to hear the word through him and do my best to find golden nuggets in there. And I feel the same way as the preacher. It's my job to try to present the word and stay out of its way. It's our job to hear the timeless truths and to pull out those words of value. It blows me away that we have this clock culture, that you know we need to beat the other tribes to the restaurant, and so you know we've got to get in front of everybody else. And I'm not accusing this church or anybody in this church of a clock culture, but we as a community, as Americans, have a clock culture. And then Jen and I go to the movies, and the movie's 2.5 hours long. And I go and pay stupid money to go sit in uncomfortable seats for 2.5 hours and try to hold my bladder so I don't miss anything. And I come up here, and I'm frustrated if the preacher talks 22 minutes. So maybe I need a heart change. Maybe I need to adjust my values, where I would be more than happy to sit and worship for 2.5 hours and maybe have a 20-minute movie. End of sermon. God bless you. Thank you for your help. God, thank you for your time. We are dismissed.